Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Roney v. The Illinois Department of Transportation. Ms. Baumann.
May it please the Court. Thank you. There are a couple things I'd like to address in response to the defendant's contentions, several of which were raised for the first time in their responsive brief. First is that Roney's claims of effective demotion is time-barred. As I said, this issue was not raised in the court below. There was originally a motion to limit the time, the allegations, and the district court judge did limit the time to July 2nd, 1997 onward. So after that point, we were engaging in discovery. All of the discovery engaged in or involved events, presumably, that took place from July of 97 onward. The IDOT has never taken the position, again, that Roney was never demoted, and I refer you to the answers to interrogatories at 10 and the statement of facts at 26. So I would suggest that this issue has been waived. We have not addressed it below. It's waived. It's non-jurisdictional. However, if the court is inclined to address whether or not he was demoted as of some prior date to that July of 97, the facts presented below establish that the conduct was of continuing nature. Lee Schmidt, who was Roney's supervisor, testified that it is sometimes necessary due to operational needs at IDOT to reassign a resident engineer to inspector positions or to positions beneath that of the ET4 resident engineer. So at that initial stage, Roney was not necessarily put on notice that they were beginning a course of retaliation. The first time Roney became aware that they had unofficially demoted or reassigned him as an inspector was when he received his performance evaluation, which was in 1998, well after the time period and would include the time period we're talking about. However, as Lee Schmidt continued to assign him as an inspector every 6 months to a person who was actually beneath him in status, beneath him in experience, and so forth, he then obviously became aware that they were engaging in retaliatory conduct. Lee Schmidt admitted that Roney was considered an experienced employee. I believe Giovanni Fulgenzi admitted that there were no prior disciplinary issues during or revolving around the time period that we're talking about, other than those two disciplinary reports, which you read quite a bit about in the briefs. But other than those, which occurred later in 99, Roney was not disciplined. He did not receive negative performance evaluations. He received no oral warnings, nothing in writing which would suggest that his performance was substandard, needed improvement, or that he was not meeting the objectives of his job. Lee Schmidt said it was unusual for him to reassign a person of Roney's experience as an inspector time and time again. Lee Schmidt also testified that he was told by his boss, Robert Rawlings, that Rawlings would have to approve any assignment of Roney as an RE as of 1997-1998. Again, defendants admitted that this was unusual, This was not their policy. This was not their practice. But in terms of Mr. Roney, he was being treated differently. Now, to give you background, in 92, Roney was part of a class of eight employees, if I recall, who were promoted to the position of ET4 resident engineer. At that time, all ET4 resident technicians were automatically also given the position as a resident engineer, and the facts do demonstrate that Mr. Roney, early on after his promotion, was engaging in very large dollar value projects and so forth. So he started out with these other seven employees. That was his class, for lack of a better term. And that those are the employees that plaintiff has tried to compare Mr. Roney with. In terms of the issue of the time period and so forth, there was no discrete act. I talked about the continuing nature of the reassignments and so forth. There was no discrete act that would have put him on notice that these things were happening or would eventually lead to his constructive discharge. Again, he received no letter. He was not told he was demoted, and so forth.
Mr. Roney's position that people who attain the position of resident engineer are never assigned to inspector responsibilities?
That is not his position. In fact, Lee Schmidt testified that there are occasions where a resident engineer would indeed be assigned as an inspector, but just that it is unusual for this to happen time and time again.
So it's the number of times that he was asked to assume that role that you believe leads to the constructive discharge.
That's one of the things that leads to the constructive discharge, and that is also one reason why this is a continuing, the retaliation is of a continuing nature.
By accepting these assignments as inspector, did that in any way limit his opportunity for advancement?
It did. Lee Schmidt, again, the record indicates, admitted that after approximately October of 1997, I believe, Mr. Roney had absolutely no opportunity for advancement. That doesn't mean things could not have turned around just because he was an inspector. It's just that IDOT's position at that point was already, he's going nowhere, we're going to keep reassigning him in this lesser position. Why it was had such an extraordinary impact on his employment was really the overtime issue. The resident engineers, for the most part, controlled the amount of overtime. I think they were confined to 250 hours of overtime within a six-month period. But other than that, they pretty much worked as much overtime within those confines as they wanted, and presumably as was necessary. Mr. Roney, because he was an inspector and was therefore being told what overtime to work and so forth, was denied a significant amount of overtime that he otherwise would have gotten. And we don't know to an absolute certainty as to the number of overtime hours that he lost, but that is not required. Statistical proof is not required. It's just if we compare Mr. Roney with his class members, I believe, Larry Prey, it's evident that he received, I think, 50% of the number of overtime hours. Now, again, these overtime hours are not part of his salary, but it is part of the practice of IDOT. This is their policy to permit the free use of overtime hours. The resident engineers, for instance, must be available on site whenever there is a contractor working and so forth. So there's reason why they are working these overtime hours. The constructive discharge issue is another issue that defendant has raised. Not only do I believe a reasonable person would subjectively and objectively feel that these continuing acts against Mr. Roney, he in 99 is writing letters to his supervisor Lee Schmidt, please stop the harassment. I believe you're retaliating against me. I would like to be placed back into the position for which I was appointed back in 1992. He again was working under people with less experience, less seniority, lower rank. So this also was a very humiliating thing for him. And humiliation in and of itself does not make it a constructive discharge, but then you add false accusations against him, where IDOT is not crediting anything he says. Lee Schmidt admits that, in large part, this is because they're concerned with the pending litigation. And to a reasonable person, IDOT has admitted that they were considering the litigation. They were considering Mr. Roney's charges of retaliation when taking these acts against him. However, at the end, the writing was on the wall. He was going to be fired. He knew he was going to be fired. He did not need to wait around. And cases, this court has been clear, you don't need to wait where you see these continuing acts, where you see that whatever you do, it's not going to matter. Whatever you say, it's not going to matter. IDOT has extensive policies and procedures. They don't follow them. They didn't follow them with regard to Mr. Roney. They didn't give him any opportunity to rebut the charges against him. And, for all of those reasons, and the other reasons that are discussed in the brief, he was constructively discharged.
Would you, Ms. Bowman, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bezaga.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, counsel for the defendant appellee in this case, and I urge the court to affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment against Mr. Roney. And if I may, I'd like to focus on the same two principal issues that the appellant has focused on, which are the constructive discharge and the alleged the timeliness of the demotion claim. I would disagree that there's been any forfeiture whatsoever of the claim that the demotion claim was time-barred. We asserted an affirmative defense that any events that occurred before the cutoff date determined by the filing of the EEOC charge were time-barred. That's in document 22 in the docket at page 15. We submitted a motion for a partial summary determination on that, which was granted, excluding any claims before that date. The discovery was open-ended. It included events that occurred before and after that date, and we're dealing now on a complete record with the issue of whether there was a demotion claim that is time-barred by the cutoff determined by the EEOC charge. I think the real issue is whether the facts, as subject to the applicable law on discrete acts, support our position that the demotion was a discrete act under the National Railroad Transportation Corporation versus Morgan analysis, following prior decisions, the Ricks, Evans, Lawrence trilogy from the Supreme Court. This was not in the nature of a sexual harassment claim or a hostile work environment claim. The demotion claim was one where the plaintiff took the position that his title prohibited, categorically prohibited IDOT from assigning him to a position below that of the top person on an IDOT project where IDOT's employees supervise construction by outside contractors. And I think the position that the plaintiff took in this case is made absolutely clear in communications he submitted to IDOT before the cutoff date. In November of 1996, he complained that his performance plan listed him as an inspector. And he, when the prior resident engineer under which he was working under a project at that time, Mr. Saeed, suddenly departed, there was a question about whether a letter originally written by Mr. Saeed had been lost or spoliated, I guess, out of his performance and personnel file. And Mr. Roney complained, and I recite this on page 7 of my brief, that it appeared that IDOT wanted Mr. Roney to consent to its biased and prejudicial review of his abilities, and that Mr. Schmidt was attempting to downgrade the performance of his work and also of his title to a lesser position. There is no doubt that Mr. Roney, before the cutoff date, complained that he had been demoted below his position of ET4 resident engineer, and the fact that he was then in a subordinate position, effectively demoted as he claims, doesn't become something that's revived simply because he stays in that subordinate position thereafter. And I would urge the court, following other decisions that treat failure to hire, failure to promote, termination as discrete acts, to likewise treat this in the same vein. It is, in fact, something that he complained about before the cutoff date. There's nothing about his assignments as somebody working as an assistant below others that changed. And the suggestion that this happened all of a sudden is, I believe, somewhat misleading. The court's prior unpublished order in Mr. Roney's prior appeal establishes that he was years late in finalizing his prior projects, and that as a result, when he finally finished them up, and was allowed to go back out into the field, he was not given any construction projects of his own. So this status goes back quite a ways. I would like to add, to the extent that opposing counsel wants to claim that he has an unblemished record because there were no disciplinary reports during the period of time from 1999 forward, that a jury found and rejected his claims of pretext, and this court affirmed the finding that he had falsified his time records, falsified his job reports, reported that he was on job sites when he wasn't there. He claimed that that was all pretext. The jury found that those disciplinary grounds by IDOT were well-founded. That's all water under the dam. That's over and done with. But it doesn't mean that he lost that case. But it doesn't mean that now he's free, as he's done in this situation, to accuse IDOT of somehow retaliating and discriminating against him when his prior performance history is checkered and problematic. And I would assert, although I don't think the court needs to go into the motive and causation issues here because there are other sufficient legal grounds to affirm the judgment below, but what Mr. Roney has done is included accusations of retaliation and harassment with other accusations that are hopelessly and clearly unfounded, that there was violence against him, that there was a conspiracy going back to 1992 to retaliate and discriminate against him, which have been conclusively determined to be wrong. And it's not improper for an employer, in the face of such accusations, to treat those independent of the accusations of harassment and discrimination and say, this person was already found to have committed insubordination, he's not somebody that we're yet going to trust with the assignment or, you know, putting him back into the position of being in charge unsupervised on major projects where he's got a past history of giving himself unwarranted overtime. That was the basis for the prior suit. They don't have to fight that again. So I think the record is clear on this one, that he was upset about having to be in a position below that of top person on IDOT projects long before the cutoff date. It was a discreet act long before that deadline. There's no basis now for him to say that every time he gets a similar assignment that that restarts his ability to complain about it. Otherwise, anytime somebody gets an assignment is assigned a different job responsibility that they complain about, they can, you know, as long as that lasts, apparently they can go back forever, and I don't think that's what the time bar limits in Title VII do.
Mr. Hussack, in light of that prior litigation, how is it that Mr. Roney is able to maintain the position of resident engineer with IDOT?
Mr. Schmidt, his supervisor, before the cutoff date, had suggested that he be allowed to final a project that was largely done on the Shermer Road project. And Mr. Rawlings, his supervisor at the time, said, no, that's not going to happen now. And Schmidt said, I'm open to, you know, to him, based upon job performance, going back into that position ultimately in the future. But it did not happen, and Mr. Schmidt identified job performance issues, and I think the record is filled with plenty of support for that, the problems that he was having, consistently refusing to work under other people, that made it inappropriate for him to be, to get back up to that position. I'd like also to address the constructive discharge claim. He claims that his working conditions were intolerable. The fact is that he had been in similar conditions for a period of 3 years, and the timing of his resignation, I think, tells the whole story. He was subject to suspension pending discharge for having fabricated time records again. There was a predisciplinary hearing. He had been given an opportunity to submit a written response to the charges. He did so. And at the morning of that hearing, a decision by all of the relevant people in the chain of command was tendered to him. He was told that he had grievance rights, that that decision could be reversed if he took it up through the grievance process. He was fully conversant with the policy personnel manual. In fact, he was citing a chapter and verse to people repeatedly. And that manual specifies that if he disagrees with the decision by the sort of human resources level of the process, that he can have the entire decision resolved upon a hearing, a full hearing before an independent panel, with a final decision to be made by the Secretary of Transportation. And although the accusations of conspiracy, fabrication, and falsification and everything else and forgery come quickly to Mr. Roney's lips, he has never suggested that the Secretary of Transportation was a part of this vast conspiracy he alleges was out to get him.
Well, this was when pre-disciplinary hearing was where he picked up the 30-day suspension, correct?
That's correct.
And what was the purpose of that hearing if IDOT had already decided it would serve him with the 30-day suspension notice on the day of the hearing?
Well, they had received written responses from him already at that time, and they had considered the information from his supervisor, who said that he was not on the job when he claimed to have worked 14 hours of overtime, and he was told not to be working there. They had information from another person who had come by the project and said that Mr. Roney wasn't there. They received Mr. Roney's written response. They thought that they had the information necessary for them to make a decision. And so they had prepared the decision. It had to be signed off on by a number of people, but it was a preliminary decision. He knew that he could seek grievance of that, although he wasn't either a union employee or subject to the personnel code. The same procedures were provided to these personnel code exempt employees, which gave them full grievance procedures and a right to have essentially a de novo independent hearing before a separate panel and then an ultimate decision by the Secretary of Transportation. And so I would submit, you know, in these circumstances, he had a choice. He was told that if he resigned, disciplinary records in his personnel file would all be expunged, or he could continue through the grievance process and seek to get it overturned with no guarantee of the outcome. He's now trying to have it both ways. He resigned that day before the close of business, which was the deadline to do so, and now wants to go in front of a jury and have them predict what the outcome of this grievance procedure would be, even though he refused to follow it. And I think the court's precedents, the Sagan case and the Witt case, say, no, you can't do that. You can't basically thumb your nose at that type of procedure and claim that you know what the outcome would be as a foregone conclusion, absent evidence that the procedure itself would have been a sham. And there is no evidence here that the procedure in front of the Secretary of Transportation would have been a sham. He simply refused to avail himself of it, and now he wants to get a second bite at the apple and claim that, oh, well, the writing was on the wall. Well, the writing wasn't on the wall as far as the procedures for the internal final administrative review of these things, not review, but determination of these things in front of the Secretary of Transportation. The idea that his working conditions were so intolerable that he was essentially forced out, I think, are belied by the fact that he'd been doing it for 3 years. And again, the timing of his decision to resign really belies the proposition that he was suffering so horribly that he couldn't continue on the job. The Souter's case establishes, I think, quite a high threshold for that, and justifiably so, because of the preference that people continue on the job while they pursue these claims until they're resolved on the merits. In the meantime, there's no legal presumption that the claims have no merit or they are meritorious, but he's got to see it through. He can't just walk away and then later argue that, I would have lost, therefore I should be entitled to recover against my employer for employment discrimination in these circumstances. I think other than if the court doesn't have any questions other than the matters that have been addressed in the briefs, I would relinquish the rest of my time and urge the court again to affirm the decision below.
Thank you, Mr. Hussack.
Thank you.
Ms. Baum.
Counsel spoke a lot about what happened, presumably, in the prior litigation. Yes, my client did lose, and it wasn't necessarily because the jury didn't believe him when he stated that he didn't do particular things. It's because they believed he didn't prove his case in total, and he didn't meet his burden of proof. If you take a look at statement number 50 in plaintiff's statement of facts, in terms of job performance issues in prior to 1997, Jan Van Bloomsten gave Roney a clean slate, and he was restored all of his back pay. So when counsel talks about him charging for overtime, inferring that he did something improper, he was paid all of that money. He remained with IDOT, and he remained in the position of resident engineer. In terms of the grievance procedure, there is an exception where there is already pending before, and I direct you to 229, Statement of Facts, the Personnel Policy Procedures Manual states that matters pending before the court, the Illinois Department of Human Rights, and or other tribunals whose decisions supersede the authority of the policy are not subject to the technical grievance procedure. This was already pending before the EEOC. Not only that, there was no point for Mr. Roney to engage in a fruitless exercise given the way IDOT treated him throughout the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.